good morning, so good afternoon. Good afternoon. My name is Bill. Hi. This is going to be an exciting afternoon. One little note of housekeeping. If you ate the spinach back there, you need to check your teeth. I already went to the bathroom and smiled and I had spinach. Yep, sure it is. So if you have the spinach, you need to check your teeth. So it's just a little word. Another point is we have a Weight Watchers representative here today and she has declared this a free day. No points. No fat, no calories, so everything's fine today. In the program, it says Marcia Memories. Hopefully by the end of the day, she's not going to say Marcia's Nightmares. We have several people who are going to tell us the scoop on Marcia. The real story behind what we see. We see Marcia, the epitome of Al-Anon. Humor, laughter, cheerfulness most of the time. So we have some people who are going to share that with us today. But Al-Anon is a family. This is Al-Anon family groups. We are a family. And one of the most powerful statements that I hear every time I go to my meeting is when it says, if I can find it, it is possible to find contentment and even happiness whether the alcoholic is still drinking or not. That was one of the most tremendous promises I think we could ask for. Not only does it give us an edge when we're dealing with alcoholics, but if we go a step further, guess what? We can find contentment and peace no matter what happens to us. So if we just remember those things, those important things that Al-Anon does for us. We see so many people here who are in recovery, who have been through so many different things. Our speaker has been through things. People who are going to talk about her have been through difficult times in their life. So, without further ado, I'm not going to make up anything about Marcia. We don't have to. And as you hear, Carol's going to be the first one to get up here and tell. Now, we had to go to another state to find Carol, which means we'll go anywhere to find some stuff about Marcia. So Carol has been with us in the past. She's from Alabama now. One of those. Yeah. But the worst thing about Carol, is the fact that she has a Florida Gator tag plate on the front of her car. So that was, we know who that was for. Okay. Then when Carol is finished, we're going to have Geraldine get up and tell the real scoop. And after Geraldine, Lynn.
I thought we were going to do this as a group.
You mean as a panel?
We have somebody to back us up.
Yeah.
Nope.
All right.
So without further ado, Carol, would you come in and share with us?
Marcia has definitely been one of the most important people in my recovery because I have gotten a lot from her. And she tells it like it is. I mean, you know, she doesn't candy coat it or anything like that. And I think about this a lot. I came into the Al-Anon office one day, and these are my favorite colors, green and brown and these things. And so I have a lot of clothes that are that color. And I came into the office one day, and Marcia was there, and I had on a pair of brown pants and a green top. And Marcia said, "You look just like a tree today. And I just died laughing. I mean, it was... Marcia's thing, for me, Marcia's things are so appropriate because for some reason that day, I know that's I needed a laugh, you know, and but it was fun, and so every time I put on, because I wear it a lot, brown pants and green top, and I think of Marcia, and I love Marcia, and there was another day later on that. I really don't remember now what was going on. I just know it was after Bill had died, and I was not in a real good place. And Marcia called me, and she said, "Are you busy?" And I said, "No." And she said she was going to come over and visit me. And in just a little bit, she came, and she arrived with the most beautiful vase of roses. And it was just what I needed that day. You know, and she has just always been there for me to watch and see how she does things. And like I said, she doesn't candy coat things. She tells you what you need to hear. And you know, that's what we need in Al-Anon is, you know, people, we don't need people that are going to tell us what we, you know, want to hear. We need people that are going to tell us what we, you know, need to hear. And I don't know that she even knows how many times I've bounced things off of her that you know, I just wanted to, you know, see if it was a good idea, and I knew she'd let me know for sure what she thought. So now I'm going to turn it over to Geraldine.
Hi there. Marcia and I have been sponsor and sponsee for a long time, and the one thing she gives me is her ear. She listens, and then when she says something, it's right on target. She's always been able to do that for me. And one of the things that I wanted to talk about was when I was in my pity pot, and I'd call her and be moaning and groaning and whatever, and I'm on the phone with her, and she says, "Poor Geraldine. Poor, poor Geraldine. Poor Geraldine. Poor, poor Geraldine." After about three times, I popped out laughing, and whatever it was gone. You know, that's what Marcia does for us. You know, that really is, and I appreciate her so much, so much. There was something else I was saying, now I forgot about it, what it is. Don't mind me. You know, I'm very forgetful sometimes. Oh, the other thing was, and I think some of you know about this, was when I was going through my divorce and then annulment. And I was complaining about that annulment because I didn't believe in them. And I'd call Marcia and say, "Guess what?" And she just listened. She just listened. And I've gone through this process, and they have all these questions and all this kind of stuff. And one day, I received this official-looking envelope in the mail from the Diocese of Baton Rouge, and it's got all of this old English font on it or whatever, and I open it up and I start reading it, and it's all this stuff about, with all that you've been through, I'm sorry we can't give you an annulment, but if you send $500 we'll make you a saint. The worst thing is she signed it, and I was saying, "Neva bon married. Neva been." It was "never been married, sister." "Sister, never been married" is how she signed it. I mean, and she was telling me that it was very difficult for her to proofread it because of the old English font, you know, but that's Marcia, you know. And one of the things was, when I was going through Mama's last months or whatever, I was just really fried. I was so worn out and whatever. And Marcia would always tell me, "You're a good daughter, Geraldine. You're a good daughter, Geraldine." And I appreciated that. Because for me and for a lot of us that come to Al-Anon, we don't think we're good enough, you know. And so that was real special for me, too. And then the last thing I want to tell you about, Marcia is not an animal person. And 3 years ago, I was thinking about getting a dog, and she was very neutral. She didn't say one way or the other about it. The only thing she asked was, "What are you going to do if you travel?" You know, and I said, "Well, my daughter's supposed to dog sit." Anyhow, so I go on and I get this little dog, and the first time after that I picked Marcia up from the airport here in Baton Rouge, I had my puppy in my lap, and we're driving back to her house, and she looked over and she said, "He is cute." Now, that's good for Marcia, who's not an animal person. Well, then about 2.5 months ago, we were going out to Kay's house in Folsom for the afternoon, and I thought my neighbor's little boy would be able to let my dog out while we were gone, and it happened that he wasn't going to be able to. So Marcia and I are at the house, and I'm thinking, well, I'll just put him in his cage and he'll just have to stay there until we get back, cross his legs or whatever. And she says, well, and Kay doesn't allow dogs in her house because she put new flooring out in Folsom. And so she says, well, you know, we're going to be outside most of the time. You could take him. It was her idea, not mine. And so I did take the dog, and he had a wonderful time. I had a wonderful time. It all worked out. But this is the tops to me. Marcia has been going to that conference in Crested Butte, Colorado for years. She and AD used to go, and then she's been going, and she's been wanting me to go, and I wasn't able to. So this year, I'm going to go with her. That's at the end of July. And so I called her one day and I said, "You know, Marcia, we haven't talked about this. You know, do you want to share a room or you want us to have separate rooms?" And she says, "Well, I'm always on the second or third floor." She says, "And you're going to have to be on the first floor." And I said, "Why do I have to be on the first floor?" She said, "Well, you're taking your dog, aren't you?" I didn't even know I could take the dog. So Marcia has come a long way. But I'm not going to ask her to dog sit, that's all. I love Marcia. I will always love Marcia. You mean a lot to me. Thank you.
All right, well, that's going to be a hard act to follow. But Marcia has taught me to have fun. And it started years ago when Marcia and AD decided to go on a hike to, Tunica Hills. And if you've ever been to Tunica Hills, it's a little bit farther to get to the waterfall than you think. So you hike and you hike and you hike. But that's been one of the greatest gifts to me for the friendship of Marcia is, you know, we come in and we've had some tough times and life has been pretty serious about some things. And Marcia has really taught me to have fun and to look at the fun side of things. And this year, you know, in her little Christmas gifts that she gives, there was a world. She gave us a little world, and, you know, so the world is ours, and so we were playing with that. I was playing with my family with that, and then I had a mouse or something, a rat or something, you know, but the only problem is I couldn't get my cat to chase it, but we had more entertaining, so it's like something that she gives that gives to get it, it's given to my family. So it's really been a way to lighten up, which is what I think we learn in Al-Anon. And the other thing is I'm on her email list. So and Marcia sends beautiful things. It's expanded my world because I never know what I'm going to get. It's pictures from all over the world of really unusual things, or it's some crazy joke, or just, you know, just something that expands my world, and I'm really, really grateful for that. And yesterday I was busy at work, but before I left I was looking at one of the emails she sent me, and it was one of these beautiful ones, and at the bottom of it there was a quote, and of course Marcia likes poetry, so she's like my mother was, always trying to expand our, you know, literary knowledge. But this one to me reminded me of what Marcia does for me. And it's a quote by Mother Teresa. And it says, "Life is an opportunity, benefit from it. Life is beauty, admire it. Life is a dream, realize it. Life is a challenge, meet it. Life is a duty, complete it. Life is a game, play it. Life is a promise, fulfill it. Life is sorrow, overcome it. Life is a song, sing it. Life is a struggle, accept it. Life is a tragedy, confront it. Life is an adventure, dare it. Life is luck, make it. Life is life, fight for it." And to me, that describes a lot of what I've learned from Marcia. So I love you, Marcia.
Well, good afternoon. I'm Kay. I'm probably the newest of this group in knowing Marcia. I entered the Al-Anon program gray, so I didn't make myself gray here. But I just feel blessed to know so many of you in this room, and the riches that you all have passed on. It has been my pleasure to get to know Marcia even more the last few years. However, as others have alluded to, she really tells you things like it is, and she doesn't beat around the bush with things, and which makes it very wonderful to be able to call her up on the phone and say whatever's on your mind. For those of you who know me, there's frequent thoughts going through my head of, I want to kill him, you know? And I had one of these one day, and to tell her about this, I had to walk down that long driveway in Folsom and get near the gate, and finally called her up and said, "Woohoo!" And I told her, I said, "I want to kill him." And she waited just that second, that pause. And I think if I paused, I might have great thoughts too. But anyway, she paused, and then she said, "Kay, you would miss him." So that kind of, it's like the fight that doesn't take place type of thing. So it made me think, and it made me think immediately. I said, "What do you miss about AD?" So all throughout the walk back to the house, I heard Marcia share what she missed about AD, or a few things. And it was delightful. I just feel so rich and so blessed to have Marcia in my life. And I know the richness in her story, and all of you here are in for a treat. There's always something to take from someone else's sharing and story. And today, I know you all will be very blessed, like we are too. Thank you.
Point of order, what Marcia meant was, she's a bad shot.
About a half a glass is all I needed, so. Thank you. It's kind of disconcerting when they ask you to speak and tell about the tragedy of your life because it's funny. Thank you, Bill. I was told not to touch it. I'm sorry. Yes? No?
Yes, you're fine.
Okay. Great. All right. I use notes. You'll be glad. We all know when I've stopped and finished together this way. I'm Marcia Fernandez McCormick Reichel, and that surprises me. I have all those names. I never expected to. My home group is Morning Glory. It's a strong, healthy, funny group. We meet Saturday mornings at the office. If you're in town, come. We go out to breakfast afterwards. It's a great, great meeting. The first thing they always want to know is, how long have you been in Al-Anon? And I don't know. I never intended to stay. I have a receipt for a piece of literature I bought in 1979. Called Al-Anon Faces Alcoholism, and that was not the first thing I bought, because I sure was not ready to face alcoholism when I got here. And I know that the AA International Convention was that summer, and I didn't go. Who would want to go and hang out with a bunch of alcoholics? You know, that'd be crazy. I was born in paradise, and that's Hawaii to you. It was just home to me. I am 7 years and one day older than my brother. I mean, he is older than I am. And all that tells you is that your parents only fooled around one time a year. I was raised in a religion that's rigid, repressive, dictatorial, paternalistic. That religion no longer exists. There are still some people who call themselves that, who think they belong to that religion, but believe me, it's a whole different religion than I was raised in. I was sent to church, and I was sent to church schools where they told me that my parents were going to hell because they didn't go to church. Mixed messages. I was fat, I wore glasses, I was very smart, and that doesn't make up for being fat and wearing glasses. That's a fundamental image I see when I look in the mirror. That's the thing I have to work around. I was never a tomboy. I was going steady when I was 11. Sometimes for just a day. And I was a knowing little girl. I used to say that the other little girls played house and we played motel. And if you've ever heard Beverly R. from Texas talk, she talks about having been visited by the chest fairy. And I was visited by the chest fairy very young. And as it turned out, some of those little boys never noticed I was wearing glasses. When I was 12 years old, my parents went to work for a banana company in Central America. That was a wonderful place to go through your adolescence. I lost the baby fat. I learned how to dance. I learned how to ride horseback. I knew that I was someplace wonderful every day. And I got to observe the grown-ups around me. Now, these were people who had never had money, who had never had servants, and so now they had leisure. They didn't have a lot of inner resources. And there was a lot of soap opera husbands and wives things going on, and a lot of drinking. And I got to observe what the English novelists call the white man deteriorating in the tropics. When I was 14, I came up to Louisiana to go to a convent boarding school, because all of the Honduranian girls came up to Louisiana and to go to school, and I wanted to get back to Honduras. That was really high on my list. And I knew if I hung out with these girls, I will get back. There was a boy, okay, but I was determined to get back. And very shortly after I got up, my parents split up, and my father went off to Europe, and my mother came and took a job at that same convent as a seamstress. And we began the life of a single mother, the poverty that's just soul-crushing, where I had beautiful, fabulous clothes because my mother was a gifted seamstress, and I had cheap shoes and cheap purses, and I knew people could tell. And it took an act of Congress to buy a tube of lipstick, and I vowed I would never be that poor again.
When I was 14 years old, I would go off with my friends in Covington, and we went dancing, we went to clubs, we carried little brown paper bags with things with initials like VO and CC and J&B. And you got setups, and you danced. And we would go to Nacol's in Slidell to hear Louis Prima. And we would go to Cave Tangi in Tangipahoa Ponchatoula, which was a bar in a basement. We went to the hill in Covington, which was off limits to convent girls. So we didn't go inside. We sat out in the car and drank. I graduated from high school at 16, and my mother shipped me off to Baton Rouge to go into nurses training. And for the first time, I was with my real peers. All of the girls in that class had been either the valedictorian or the salutatorian of their high school class, and they were smart, and I really had to study. But the main thing I learned was how to go to work, which I had not known, but it was the deal was you got up, you got dressed, you cleaned up your room, you went to chapel, you went to breakfast, and then you went up on the floor and you told your supervisor that you were sick. Well, by that time you were awake, you were up, you were dressed, you just stayed and did it. About a year into it, one of my friends there said, "I wish I had done what I wanted to do in the second place." And that was the way I was beginning to feel. And one day I walked into the lab and they were sitting down. Now, we never got to sit down in student nurses. They were sitting down. They were smoking cigarettes. They were listening to the radio. And I thought, I have gotten into the wrong end of this deal. And very shortly after, I resigned and went home. This was a surprise for my mother, who had no idea. And for years after, whenever I came home from any place, she would say, "Did you quit? Did you?" Sort of marked her. And I went to Covington. I went to Hammond to college. Now, I'd already spent a year of the money in nurses training, so I had to really move it up a lot quicker. So I did a 3-year course in 2 years in two summer schools, and was still a few credits short, but I ended up back in Baton Rouge for MedTech internship. By 20, I was suicidal and seriously depressed. We were taking tranquilizers and booze. We took a lot of Compazine and Librium because we said we were nervous. And tranquilizers and booze will make you depressed. Who knew? I was running with a wild and crazy crowd of desperate fun seekers. Most of them were gay. In fact, when I met my husband, the first thing I asked him, "Are you straight?" He thought that was so funny. But I wasn't meeting many men who were. And I was a pessimist because I figured if you always expected the worst, you couldn't be disappointed. I always liked the tall, skinny, smart guys, and along came Mark. He was brilliant. He read everything. He remembered everything. He had a funny, quirky sense of humor. He said he wanted to live forever, and I found that enormously attractive, enormously attractive. He taught me to read critically. He taught me to please myself. He would say, I'd say, "Do you like this?" And he'd say, "Where would you want to work?" You know? He drank differently. Okay, we used to say he had a fast metabolism. Mm-hmm. He got drunk quickly. He didn't have hangovers. And I thought, this is his problem. It never occurred to me it would ever become my problem. It was his problem. He used to say he was missing a switch that told him when to stop drinking. And I knew about those switches because I was missing a food switch. I'm always amazed when people say, "I could never eat another bite." And I'm thinking, of course you can eat one more bite. Where is your discipline? We were at a friend's house one night and hungry and late, insisting that she produce some kind of food thing. And she went off in the kitchen and she came back with something on Ritz crackers. It was nasty looking. I ate a bunch of them. And she's watching me with big eyes. And she said, "How do you like it?" And I said, "You know, not much. It was cold and gray and yuck." And she said, "It's canned rattlesnake." Well, it's hard to pretend to any kind of moral superiority when you know you are the kind of person who would eat canned snake on a cracker. I did not believe that I had ever seen any happy marriages. I had 3 rules for marriages. I'd gotten them all from ladies' magazines.
The first one was never use his razor. It made men crazy angry. Who knew why? The second was never start a sentence with the words, "If you love me." And the third was always to be the kindest to somebody who had a hangover, because that's when they felt the worst, they deserved it the least, appreciated it the most. I can remember driving around so conflicted before we got married that night, because I didn't know if I was doing the right thing. We went to a justice of the peace who had stood up for some friends of ours a month before, and we chose him because his wife served a glass of jug wine after the ceremony. So sophisticated. I got pregnant instantly, no waiting. We moved to Jersey City to have the baby. My son was born a Yankee, God forbid. Jersey was just terrible. We lived in an antique apartment. We didn't know anybody. We just went to work and were pregnant and went home, and we drank. We drank all through that. We didn't know in those days that you were not supposed to. I didn't touch it.
I don't know.
All right. I don't know, he said. After the baby was born, my brother and my mother came up to see the baby, and we went out to dinner, and then they went back to their hotel, and Mark and I sat there and continued to drink, and he said, "You know, this has been a terrible mistake. We should never have gotten married. This, I'm sorry you've been through a lot of pain and you've been through a lot of trauma. I wish I could make it that it was not so, but this was a mistake." And then he went to bed. And I thought, you know, if I just go to bed, he won't even remember this conversation. It will be as if it never happened. And so I got up and I took the bottle of scotch and I rode the subway over to New York City and I got a hotel, cheap hotel room, and I considered my options. And I realized, okay, I can be a single mother. I can raise my son on my own. I can go back to Baton Rouge and get a good job. I can do this. And so the next morning I got up and I had gone over to the Port Authority bar and I was drinking a Bloody Mary and doing the New York Times crossword puzzle when in walked my husband and my brother, who had shown him how you go looking for a wife, because he sure didn't know. And he came over and patted me on the fanny, and we all went back to Jersey, and that was it. But I was never comfortable with him drinking again, because there's a Latin expression, in vino veritas, in wine there is truth. And I didn't know when he was going to start drinking and start telling me truth, start telling me things I did not want to hear. My mother moved in with us, and I went to work, and he went back to school, and in a couple of years, it was my turn to go back to school, and I decided that I wanted to retrain. I wanted to become a cytotechnologist, and that's the person who screens pap smears. And it involved having to go to Charity Hospital and live in squalor in the YWCA and take the Greyhound bus back and forth on weekends, but I knew I could do anything for 6 months, and I did that. Cytotech turned out to be my career, my chosen career, my life work. I loved it. And people will say, how can you sit and look down a microscope for 6 hours a day? But it's like finding seashells on the seashore. You don't know what you're going to find in the next field. It is just constantly interesting. And you know when you find it, you're going to find it when they can still do something about it, so it's worthwhile doing. And it was so dire and so important that we couldn't make mistakes, and I'm a girl who doesn't make mistakes. That was my kind of job. Those people became my closest friends. My boss was professionally generous. He wrote articles and gave me co-credit. I mean, that is rare if you know about how that's done. And when my son was 4 years old, my husband said, "It's time for your mother to leave. As long as your mother stays here, you're never going to grow up. You're going to continue to let her do everything." And I was in a panic. I didn't want to be left with this man that I wasn't even related to, that I was just, and I didn't know when he was going to start telling me truth things. But when I examined it, I realized he was right. You know, I was terribly dependent on my mother. And So she went back to Covington, and 7 years later, when they had a change in the administration, she could call and say, can I come back? And I could say yes, because by that time I was the mistress of my house. I was the mother. It turned out I had a talent for marriage. We were married for 26 years, and he was my best friend. He was never angry with me. We were always doing for each other. He would go off in quests to find things and come back with wonderful stories about how he had beaten back the world to, you know, and finally I would have to say, does this have a happy ending, so that I could listen to the story and appreciate it. We had one set of friends that we saw too much of, ending up and falling out with them, and then he started drinking heavily, and I thought, he's lonely, you know, so I reinitiated contact. And that was my pattern, to try to fix it, to try to change it, to try to make it better. She is still my friend today. She's wise and witty and a lot of fun. And he was a psychologist, and I could tell him anything. We had a wonderful relationship. If you are prey to depression, you kind of get careful about what you say to other people, because you just never know. You know, people's insides don't match their outsides. But with him, he had such an intact ego, and we had the same mean sense of humor, and I could tell him anything and get back as good as I gave. Mark was unhappy at work. He wasn't ambitious, but he hated that other men were getting promoted over him. And I suggested he go back to school. See, this is my pattern. Find a way to fix it. And he soon found out that school was going to take too long, and it wasn't going to produce the amount of money that he was going to need. So, you know, then he started casting about looking for a career. And this was his pattern, to try to find something that required him to learn all kinds of things and spend all kinds of money to support it, and then find out that he couldn't do it for good reasons. And, for instance, photography. Photography for me is very much like standing on the roof and lighting $20 bills and throwing them over the side. He got into photography. He took courses, he read books, he bought cameras, he bought still cameras, movie cameras, lights, filters, everything that you could imagine. He took wonderful photographs, thousands of them that he had developed at the most expensive photography store in Baton Rouge. And then he began casting about, what do you do as a photographer? Well, it turns out that what most photographers do is they take pictures at weddings. And that has nothing to do with photography. That's to do with, can you work with a crazy woman? Can you work with a crazy woman's mother? And he couldn't, and I knew he couldn't. So that was the end of that career. He asked me to take over the finances because it depressed him. Don't know why it didn't occur to me, it depressed me too. And we acquired more friends, and they were all heavy drinkers. If you drink alcoholically, your friends become heavy drinkers. They're the only people who will tolerate being around people who drink alcoholically. And all of our social life became alcohol dependent. We didn't go to movies because it takes too long. You don't get a drink. Who can do this? When you're invited to a party, you don't just go to a party. You have to figure out, are they going to serve liquor? Are they going to serve it strong enough? Are they going to serve it soon enough? Are they going to serve it long enough? How much do I have to drink before we go so that I can make it through until they start serving it? Just a lot of thought. But meanwhile, I was the frugal housewife. I was buying it by the case because I got a 15% discount. And this was my first reality check. Christmas week, I knew I had to go buy booze. And Christmas week in the liquor store is hell because it's filled with people who come in to buy their one bottle of liquor for Christmas, you know, and it's Manischewitz or Cold Duck or something horrible. And I'm thinking, this is going to be a bad one, but I've just got to do it. And sure enough, I got to the liquor store, and it was filled with people, and the owner was working with somebody at the counter, and when the door opened and I came in, he dropped that customer and said, Mrs. McCormick, can I help you? And I thought, you know, I must spend a lot of money here. I must be a very good customer. I didn't know that. And by now he had found his final profession, which would have driven a sane man crazy. He obtained a black box invention that reputedly located subterranean water. It required that he learn geology, hydrology, electricity, electronics, wave theory, magnetic resonance, oscilloscope instrumentation, small engine repair, power supplies, patent and contract law, fundraising, IRS depreciation schedules. And he did. He learned all that stuff. He had to renovate and redesign this ancient tube equipment and turn it into electronic stuff. He had to keep a used four-wheel drive suburban van running. He had to deal with a recalcitrant generator that was supposed to run the equipment, and every time he would go off to do a demonstration, the box wouldn't work because he couldn't get electricity to it. And years later, we discovered that we were always setting the generator for below sea level and then going off to do a demo someplace else, and that's why the generator never worked. He did this all with a political science degree. I mean, no science background at all. He was his own boss. He had no routine. He had no hours. He had no salary. And there was constant renegotiation with backers and constant refinancing with banks. And meanwhile, our son was struggling through junior high. He had what I characterized as a lethal gene, the combination of two normal genes that together he got his father's inability to fight, and he got his mother's mouth, and he could not shut up, and he was getting beaten up every day at school. I mean, they dragged him out during phys ed class and beat him up. And we realized if he was going to survive junior high, we would have to put him in a private school, which we could not afford, but what are you going to do? And he hated it, of course. He got A's if he liked the teacher, and he got F's if he didn't like them. And as an adult, he told me that one of his little things was to take an exam and get every single answer wrong, which statistically, of course, is impossible. But, the teachers never tumbled to it, so what smart kids do to annoy their parents. Eventually, we allowed him to drop out as a junior in high school and take the GED, and he went out to LSU and did a semester there, but he was partying and living in an apartment. And so eventually he went off to Lafayette and went to college there and worked. He worked two and three jobs all the way through from high school, early high school on, because he was supporting a car habit. And we went to our friend, the psychologist, because he was the only one who could treat him for free, and said, "What is the problem?" And he said, "Well, he has found out that his father is not the king." I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, that means he is not the prince." I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, that means he may never be the king." But I thought he judged us too harshly. But somewhere along the line, I had found Al-Anon. As always, I started in the library, both of us. This was our pattern. We researched a subject thoroughly. We weighed all the evidence carefully. We examined every possible outcome. And then we made the dumbass decision over and over and over. There's a philosophical postulate that says the simplest explanation that fits all of the facts is probably correct. It's called Occam's razor because it cuts to the core of any inquiry. And Occam's razor for us was alcoholism. It explained my life. It explained why we worked so hard and couldn't get ahead. And it explained why we couldn't finish projects. It explained why we couldn't keep promises. Now, I knew what a 12-step program was, and I knew it couldn't work for us. We didn't do religion. And I knew it couldn't work for us because we were intellectuals. Huxley defines an intellectual. An intellectual is someone who doesn't think about sex all of the time. We qualify. I don't know why I came, except that there was nothing else to do. I had no place to go. I was out of ACEs. And I went to my first meeting at Club 12. And they took one look at me, and they sent me to that big room in the back. And there were a bunch of people sitting around the table. and they said, "This is a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous," and they all turned and looked at me, and I just stared them down. I thought, I got as much right to be here as any of you. And that turned out to be a very good meeting for me. This was not your Rolex, AA. These were people with real living problems. And my memory of that night was the discussion. There was a man who had escaped from Angola. And the group conscience seemed to be that he should go back and make amends. He didn't. But as I say, it was a good meeting for me. There were other people in Baton Rouge who were having real living problems. And the next night I went back and I found the Al-Anon meeting up front. And I don't know why I stayed, because you people kept telling me things I did not want to hear. You told me it was a disease, and I thought, it can't be. If it was a disease, I would be fixing special diets, I would be exercising with him, I would be doing stuff, and I was angry. And I finally understood that it's a disease, but it's like diabetes, that there's things that the person has to do to take care of themselves. You told me you didn't cause it, and I didn't want to hear that, because I could see right away that meant I couldn't cure it. You told me you have choices, and I thought, no, I had choices, and I made bad ones, and now I have consequences. But it was like I was standing with my nose so close to the wall that I couldn't see the wide range of choices in front of me. You said you have to let him hit bottom, and I thought, he's not going down there alone. When he hits, I'm going to bounce. You know, we are attached. And you told me I would have to detach. And I said, but, you know, I'm attached to him. I love him. That's what that means. I'm attached to him. And someone explained to me that for him, being attached was like being a marionette, and you were attached to somebody with long strings, and every time they moved, you got jerked around. You told me it was a spiritual program, and I thought I had purely temporal problems. You were worrying about my higher power coming into my life. I was worrying about the sheriff coming in the door. And the thing that really terrified me the most, you'd go around and people would say, I've been coming for 2 weeks. And somebody would say, I've been coming for 6 months. And somebody would say, I've been coming for 10 years. And that was terrifying. I couldn't even watch a continued TV show at that point. I was so afraid of commitment. Now I know that what they were telling me was, here is something, after 10 years, it still works. Al-Anon explained the past, the present, the future. I didn't know my father was an alcoholic. I didn't get to see him at the end of his life, when you can tell. He had boogied out of our lives when I was 14. I knew that he was a rotten husband and a poor father and a wonderful friend. He was the guy who would come down and bail you out of jail with a trunk full of beer. But I thought he was insensitive and rude, and I vowed I would never marry a man like my father, and I didn't. I married a man who was totally different. They only had the one thing in common. My brother and I had to go to Miami to bury him when he died, because his second family was not legal. And my brother said, "You're not crying." And I said, "For me, he died a long time ago." Al-Anon explained the present. You told me that my husband had a fatal progressive illness. All of our friends just kept saying, if he would slow down, if he would cut back, if he would control it. You were the first people who told me, he's dying of this. You told me, Al-Anon gave me the future. You told me my son was at risk. He already had his first DUI. I know we all think that the police just park out in front of those lounges and pick up those poor boys. There are a lot of people who have never had a DUI in this town. I know that's amazing, but it's true. But my gift was, I got to talk to my son while he still could hear me. I got to say, you are getting depression and alcoholism on both sides, and neither of these are good coping mechanisms. You're going to have to do something different if you want to stay alive. And he didn't fall on his knees and have a conversion, but my gift was, I talked to him and he heard me. By the time I knew what was going on with my husband, he couldn't hear me. In 1982, everything fell apart, and I moved to the Roach Motel for a month in protest. My friend, the psychologist, had a cranial aneurysm, and they did a prefrontal lobotomy, and his body lived for many years, but his mind was gone. My boss was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. We knew he was failing, and we did a lot of things to make sure that he didn't make any mistakes. But one day they walked in and said, "We're taking over the lab, and now you work for us." And I said, "No, I don't have to work for you." And they said, you know, all that usual stuff. "You'll never work in this town." And I said, "You know, I can starve." And we were both right. And my husband said, "Come and work for me. We'll work the machine together." And so I gave him the checkbook, and I turned my life and my will over to the care of my husband. He considered going into outpatient treatment to get me to come home from that motel. And he went down, and they gave him the alcoholism test. It was two questions. Do you have insurance? And are you willing to go into treatment? 50% is a passing grade for that test. But then, meanwhile, the black box suddenly took off, because by this time the backers had decided if you can find water, you can find oil. And that was really interesting to these Texas oilmen. They sent us off to run the machine in Kentucky. At that time, Kentucky was paying a premium to whoever brought in the first well. And so we moved to Kentucky, and we lived in a motel room, the two of us, a one-room motel room for 3 months. That will test your marriage. Eventually moved to a house. We would have to drive 60 miles over terrible mountain roads that he was terrified of to get to a liquor store in Kentucky, in Tennessee, because we were living in a totally dry county. And the clerk there said, "I guarantee you, when you left Louisiana, they knew it." Said, "We can trace beer drinkers all over the country." Who knew? 6 months later, we crawled home, defeated. Once again, the box had failed, and as always, the results were inconclusive but promising. We were losing the house, and I thought, I'm going to hate it if we lose the house. The house was a wreck, but we had an acre and a half in Old Goodwood, and I just hated to lose it. So I went down and got a job as a med tech again, a bench tech, and it was a very low-pressure job with very supportive coworkers and creditors calling all the lab all day long, and he just was in a stupor, just drinking. And finally, I said, "You know, this is not worth dying for. Sell the house. And we sold the house and split it three ways because we owed my mother a great deal of money. And we all went our separate ways. My mother found, she and I, a house there in the neighborhood, and I went down and got a legal separation. When the worst thing happens and you lose everything, freedom follows. That was not my bottom. Material things were not that important, as it turned out. And life was sad, but it was peaceful. And 6 months later, he appeared at the door. He was broke and bruised and bleeding, and my mother let him in, and she loved him too. And so he came to live, sleeping on my living room couch. They say when an alcoholic quits drinking, his disease is arrested. If he drinks again, it picks up right where he left off. I'm here to tell you it is the same for an Al-Anon. When I was suddenly faced with alcoholism again, I was instantly crazy. I was as crazy as I had ever been. And of course, my disease had been merely arrested. I wasn't doing steps. I wasn't working a program. Within 2 weeks, I was crazy as ever. I was suicidal. That was my bottom. I went to a treatment center because they were offering a class on how to cope, and I knew I wasn't. And it turned out there was really a class on how to do an intervention. But what he said was, "Go to Al-Anon." And I thought, I knew that. Mm-hmm. So I came back to Al-Anon. And I began to work the steps on an emotional gut level. My friend Rosemary says, "Work it like your hair's on fire." Mm-hmm. That's what I was doing. Powerless, yes. I could see I was powerless. But unmanageable, I was doing everything. I thought I was living a totally rational life. I didn't know you could be rational and crazy as a bedbug at the same time. came to believe, and I would say, how? Just tell me how to do it. I'm willing to do it. Just tell me, how do you believe? And I can remember at a meeting, and this woman kept talking about the gift of faith, the gift of faith, and I was so frustrated. And I finally said, I didn't get the gift of faith. I got the gift of pride. And she said, pride's not a gift, it's a sin. Restored us to sanity. There was a lady who would say with such relish, we are so sick. We are so sick. And I thought, you goose, you really are sick. Made a decision. I could not do that. I couldn't make that decision. I wasn't willing to turn my will and my life over to God. I didn't know God, what God would do, but I knew bad things often happen to God's chosen people. And I was reluctant. I was reluctant. And I finally read that step, and it says, to the care of God, which is a very loving, a very different thing. A moral inventory. I did a moral inventory because all the big kids had done a moral inventory, and I couldn't even talk at fourth step meetings until I did. And I found that I did it as an inventory. What do I have on the shelf? Where did I get it? Do I want to buy some more of it? Do I want to get more of it? Do they have something better now that I could be using? And I found my virtues and my character defects were all on the same continuum. And I can find very good words to define character defects. Like, I would tell you I was loyal, I was a stand-up woman. You know, that was pride, that I was not willing to admit that I had judged quickly. I would tell you that I was persistent and stick-to-itiveness, you know, unyielding. Stubborn is another word. They told me you have to pray. That's what faithful people do. They pray. And so I would pray, heal them, comfort them, bless them. And I prayed that over and over and over. And not a damn thing happened. And I thought, well, this doesn't work. And then I read the step, and it said, prayed only for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry that out. And my prayer became, higher power, you know what I need, take care of me. I don't have to enumerate it. My higher power knows what I need. I'm really saying it to remind myself that my higher power knows and that he will take care of me. And I began to feel better. And when I examined it, I realized that as long as I was praying for other people, for all I know, God was blessing them or healing them or whatever, but I don't have any way of knowing. I only know when it's in my life. And so when I started praying for me, I could see the difference. And I use that now. When I pray for people, at the end of it, I always say, and me too, God, and me too. I got a sponsor. She was a double winner because I was afraid you Al-Anons would try to fix me, and I knew she was too busy. And she told me that you can love somebody to death. And she told me, you're standing between him and his recovery. As long as you keep whipping in there and doing for him, God cannot act in his life. And when I hit a plateau, they told me to get into service work. And I was just stuck in the program. And so I agreed, and I was appointed GR for a small group. And this is how it often happens. And I thought it was for 1 year, and I found out it was 3 years, but I thought, okay, you know, I signed on. Well, you know, how you become a GR for a group is you go to that meeting every week. You never schedule anything at that time. You go whether it's raining or you're sick or nobody shows up or whatever. That is your meeting. And after 6 months, I was in a whole lot of better place. And I thought, why should I be in a better place? I mean, there's not a whole lot of commitment to being a GR. You go to assembly a few times a year. You talk about the forum, and you attend that meeting faithfully. And when I examined it, I realized that, okay, the difference was somewhere way in the back of my mind, there was an invisible barrier. And when I agreed to be there for 3 years, that barrier dropped. I never even knew it was there until it was gone. Home was hell. You could just smell the despair and the defeat. But I was detaching with my feet. And God had begun working in my life. I changed careers. I was a brain dead at that little laboratory. And I got a job working for the state doing economic development research, which was something I knew nothing about, but of course I can do anything.
I got a second job nights, and I desperately needed the money because I was going under. I did not make enough money to support my mother and I, and I got a second job screening pap smears at night. And God has such a sense of humor. I went to work for a girl named Marcia. We called her Marcia Prime, and I was Marcia Past Prime. And they called me Midnight Marcia. And she was just driven. She had to know everything you were doing. She had to follow behind you. She had to check and make sure you did it right. It was just like working for myself. It was such an eye-opener. It made me a better person. And I had changed playmates. I can remember being invited to a divorce party one night. A friend had her ex was remarrying the night that the divorce became final, the turd. And so she was going to give a divorce party. So I was getting dressed to go out, and my husband said, you know, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to my Friday night meeting, and that I'm going to an Al-Anon party. And he said, an Al-Anon party, that's a contradiction in terms. And I was so clueless, all I could say was, well, we can drink. I mean, I really had no clue that people did anything social without drinking. I knew that there were people who didn't drink, and they called themselves hard-shell Baptists. And when I was in college, they had play parties, whatever those were, but I thought you drank. And I went to the party, and lo and behold, nobody drank, but it was just as wild and crazy and fun as anything I'd ever been to. There was only one difference, as far as I could see, and that was that at 2 o'clock in the morning, when everybody said, let's get up tomorrow morning and go do such and such, they showed up the next day. They remembered it. We went to picnics, we went to breakfast, we went to coffee, we went hiking. We went canoeing. The guy was a horseman who was my partner, and he was wearing cowboy boots. We turned that canoe, leaving the dock, I mean, no waiting, and we rolled it 3 or 4 more times going down that short creek. He lost his glasses. He had to drive back to Baton Rouge without his glasses. He bought his first pair of sneakers the next week. But my dirty little secret, the thing that I would not talk about in meetings, was that I was suicidal. I could not think of anything else. And I wouldn't talk about it in meetings because I thought I was so persuasive. If I told you, you would join me. it was such a good solution. And I finally decided to go to the suicide prevention, that they were a risk. That was their job, you know, tough luck. And she explained to me that I was angry because he wasn't trying to live, and I was filled with grief that I couldn't save him. And I had a lot of survivor's guilt. And I can remember thinking, you know, don't make me admit that I can live without you. Because once I do, the genie's out of the bottle. I can't go back. I can't go back. And suddenly, out of a clear blue sky, he went down to New Orleans and put himself in VA 28 days. He had been to the point that he lasted as long as he did because he ate well, and I would fix all of these meals, and he would take them, and he would eat one bite, and then he'd put the dish in the refrigerator and say, thank you, you've saved my life. And it was killing me, because food is love. And she said, you don't have to do that. He's a grown man. If he's hungry, he'll get food. And he was trying to quit smoking, and so he would gather up all of his cigarette butts in a paper bag, and then he'd spill them out over the coffee table and pick them for the largest one, and it was so pathetic, it was killing me. And she said, it's your house, you don't have to do that. Tell him that's upsetting, tell him to take it outside. And so I went home in fear and trembling, and when he spilled those cigarettes, I said, would you mind doing that outside, it upsets me. And he said, oh sure, who knew it was going to be that easy. He said, why don't you hide the booze? You know, then I, you know, I couldn't drink. And I thought, I'm going to provide your entertainment while I'm at work. You know, I've had some Al-Anon, thank you. So he went down to the VA. He did so well. He's that 30-day treatment. They let him out in 28 days. He drank that evening. He drank the next day. He drank the next night. And when I said, why did you put yourself through that if you weren't going to make a better attempt? And all he could say was, it was time. It was time. And for the first time, I took off my wedding ring.
And he went off to do a demonstration, and they called me that he was in a coma in a motel room in Bunky, Louisiana. And I explained that we were legally separated, and he was a veteran, so they moved him to the VA in Alexandria. And I would not go to see him. I would not go to see him. That was not a loving decision. That was a rational decision. But I was so afraid that he would come to and find me sitting beside his bed and think that I had come to rescue him again. And there were things he was going to have to do if he wanted to stay alive, and I couldn't do them for him. I continued to go to meetings and to coffee, but I was afraid that something bad was going to happen while I was out having a good time, and that was so scary. And God's grace for me was I got the message that he had died as I came home from my home group meeting that night. They called me. My son came for the funeral, and he didn't cry. And when I asked, he said, for me, he died a long time ago. My son lives in Oregon. He has a small software firm that they're doing very well. As far as I know, he's okay. God led me to a temporary job at the department. They sent me to IBM to learn programming, and I had to do something different for 8 hours a day, and that was a blessing. And the rest of the time, I cried. I cried all of the time. I lost 40 pounds because you can't eat and cry. I cried when I was driving, and that's really dangerous. I cried at meetings. I couldn't even speak. And somebody said, the fact that you are still coming to meetings, you are a witness. You are a witness. It's okay. I cried in the grocery store because I'd go up and down the aisles and I would see the things that he loved and I would have bought for him. And I would just cry. And I could see people in the aisles watching me out of the corners of their eyes. And I knew they were thinking, there's a woman who hates the grocery shop. And my normal friend said, why are you still going to Al-Anon? And I said, because I feel like I've just been hit by a truck and I want to know the make of that, the model of that truck, everything that I can learn about that truck. And I had quit drinking. And they said, you know, why aren't you drinking? You know, you're not alcoholic. And I said, when you've just seen someone eaten by lions, you don't want to pet cats. Death rearranges your priorities. You know, I really thought that I was going to stick it out and we were going to live happily ever after and everybody was going to say that I did right to stick it out and, you know, wah, wah, wah. I don't think that way anymore. When I went to my first AA convention, somebody came up to me and said, Marcia, you haven't changed a bit. And I turned around and it was the last guy that I had dated before I married my husband. Do we select for alcoholics? I don't know. I don't think it's the bait. I think it's the fishing holes. And I think if you keep fishing in holes for sackalay, you're going to catch crappie. But I do know that healthy people attract healthy people. He said, you haven't changed a bit. And I said, I don't want to hear that. I remember looking wonderful. I distinctly remember that. But I thought, boy, have I changed. You know, I've changed my beliefs, my behavior, my response, my perceptions. I actually changed my mind. I changed my personality. I don't know if I'd ever gone into this if I'd known I was going to change my personality. I became a positive thinker. I became an optimist. Who knew that was even possible? One cold winter's evening, there was a sad, lonely man sitting across from me. Hadn't seen him for a few weeks because he was having some horrible thing going on in his life. And at the end of the meeting, we all prayed, and he ducked and ran. You know how we do. And I thought, I'm going to go out and catch that man and give him a hug. And I whipped out and caught him in the parking lot and said, I'm going to give you a hug. And it was winter and it was cold. I was wearing a cape and he put his arms around me under the cape and he hugged me fiercely, just fiercely. And I thought, he really needed a hug. And I went back inside to the meeting and got some more hugs. And when I saw him later on, I said the other night, you really needed a hug. And he said, I was thinking, you know, what if I don't let her go? What if I never let her go? What if I just keep holding on And I thought, whoa, he has an interesting mind. And I really looked at him, and I realized that he was tall and skinny. And I thought, he might be smart. And he was very smart, but he was no intellectual, if you get my drift. And there I was, this kind, loving, generous man, this kind, loving, married man, this loving, married man with a wife in a nursing home. And I could not believe it. I could not believe this was happening to me, morally superior me. I went to my sponsor. I told her what I was doing. And she looked off into the middle distance and said, "The programs offer many comforts to the discreet." You gotta love sponsors. That man loved me back to life. Without ever discussing it, we both chose to honor our commitments, to fulfill our responsibilities. Neither of us needed any drama in our lives. We didn't need any soap operas. We didn't need any excitement. And we diligently avoided scandal. We avoided acting like a couple. We always sat opposite each other, but that wasn't about coupling. It was that we liked to look at each other. We liked to see each other during meetings. Some of our observant friends observed. There was an AA who nailed me right away. But our friends in Texas, our oldest Al-Anon couple friends, knew that. And I remember a couple of years later that she said, you know, her daughter said, "Why don't those two get married? You know, they're obviously so much in love. Why don't they get married?" And I said, "Did you explain to her that some of us are already married?" And she said, "I'd forgotten." Okay. 5 years later, he was honorably discharged, and we were able to marry. And what do you say about a marriage in the program? Was a marriage made in hell? I married that loving, gentle, joyous man, and he would do anything for me, but he wouldn't do everything for me. And he took care of himself, and he expected me to take care of myself. He lived a strong program. He worked the best program of anyone I ever knew, and therefore he was my sponsor. And people say, "How can you have your husband as your sponsor?" I could come to him and say, "I have a sponsor problem," and he could put on his sponsor hat. He could give me his spiritual solution. Excuse me. We always went to at least one different meeting a week, alone, without the other one, so that if there was ever a problem, we would have a place to take it. He brought two wonderful daughters and three grandchildren. I would have missed having grandchildren to our marriage, and they are continuing delight. And when we tell people that we never ever had a fight or an argument, and they say, "How can that be?" And we explain, well, we were retired, we had enough time, we had enough money, the children lived elsewhere, and they were all taking care of themselves, supporting themselves, and I couldn't get pregnant. There's nothing left to fight about. We traveled widely, and we attended Al-Anon meetings everywhere we went, all over the world, and we always felt at home. And when he was diagnosed with cancer, I was able to call. He wasn't ready to have to go through chemo, and I was able to call on the experience of friends in this program who had been through chemo and who could come and tell him, "You can do this." And that last year was so sweet. It was so sweet because we knew our days were numbered, and it was gorgeous. There were so many, you know, grief is the price you pay for loving people, and I would not have missed him for the world. The last year, he was so at peace, and I was given the chance when he was dying to do for him what I had not been able to do for my first husband. And I had flowers all over the house, and I had soft music playing, and people were coming to thank him and to hug him and to tell him how much they loved him. It was beautiful. everyone wants to come and die at my house. And I'm remaking my life without its center. I cut my hair, which is a classic expression of grief. He had taught me to travel, and he told me to keep traveling. And the first Christmas I couldn't stand it, I went and took a sailing schooner ship through the Caribbean. I found that I can travel with Al-Anon friends. Somebody came up, said, I'm going to Africa, and she said, I want to go too, and we went and did a safari together. I took a small ship cruise on the inland sea in Japan with my son. And then I have traveled everywhere alone, just in groups, whatever. I found I can do this. One of my most important Al-Anon gifts was that I no longer ask why. I finally figured out that when you're asking somebody why, you know, it doesn't matter. The sky is blue. Why? That's reason enough. Now I just say the sky is blue. And when I ask people why, it's like I'm asking them to justify why they're doing what they're doing. I used to look around at meetings and think, you know, we all have the same problem. And that was so safe and so comforting. And I realize now a lot of people have that problem. That's not what distinguishes us. What distinguishes us is that we have the same solution. And in closing, this generation thinks that they invented reality TV. No. In the 1940s, there was a radio show, a very famous radio show. It was so great that it became a TV show in the 1950s, and that show ran for 20 years. And the gist of the show was that they gathered three women together, and they sat and told them their tragic, terrible, horrible lives. And the one who had the most tragic story was then the winner, and she was crowned queen for a day. And I figured that makes me queen for the day. Thank you.
Now, Sir Mike, how does it feel to be knighted in royalty? Thank you so much, Marcia. She is an example of the power of this program. During the few weeks that I've been putting this together, working with Geraldine and others, I have been to many, many meetings. And the one thing that goes through everything, people are thankful for this program. They're thankful for what it's done for them. They're thankful for giving them their life back. They're so thankful. So I suggest, if you ever want to pick me up, just get the list and go to meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting. You'll be amazed at what it will do for you. It will emphasize the power of this program. I know.
My control issue.
We want Marcia to know how much we appreciate the fact that she took her time out to come to be with us today, to share her story about what Al-Anon has done for her. This is just a little token of our appreciation that we'd like to give. She grabbed it and said, "Feels like a bottle."
Initials.
Does not have any initials. No VO, nothing like that. It's a jar. It's not a bottle. Somebody mentioned that this is the birthday of Al-Anon Baton Rouge or
Heritage Day.
Okay. We have anyone else have? I know one other person has a birthday today. Barbara, sitting right down in front of me. Wait, Barbara. This is Al-Anon's anniversary birthday. Anyone else have a birthday they would like to share? Yeah, come on. And in closing, I'd like for us all to stand together. Hold hands with one another. And we're going to do one of the most powerful statements that Al-Anon has, our closing declaration, which begins,
"Let it begin with me. When anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help, let the hand of Al-Anon and Al-Anon always be there, and let it begin with me."
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.